You are listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Today we're in Otakam.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And we will shortly be joined by Daniel Freeb. He's sending a vital email as we speak. But we are rejoined by Francois Thomazeau. Hello, Francois.
Hi there.
Very popular request, especially from the Doncaster area, after your revelations in your last appearance on the podcast that you were formerly a French waiter in Doncaster.
I was, yeah, absolutely. Nothing to add to that, you know, once you've said you've been a waiter in Doncaster, I mean, it says it all, doesn't it?
It does indeed. Now, Francois, when we last had you on the podcast, we were looking ahead in anticipation and hope at some of the young French riders. They have certainly lived up to whatever expectations we had, and probably exceeded them, I think. Have they exceeded your expectations?
They have, in a way. I mean, I probably told that, you know, I'm an old man now, so sometimes I repeat stuff, but I might have told you the last time that I've seen Thibaut Pinot ride in his first Tour of Romandy. I think it was one of his first major races as a pro. And he was already very, very impressive on a bike, especially when it climbed. So I'm not very surprised by Pinot. He has a margin, you know, of progression that's very impressive. Perrault is you know, he's old. He's 37 years old. But everybody says you can't tell how far he can go because he's such a young road rider after doing mountain bike for many years. I was talking to Vincent Lavenu, his director sportif, this morning, and Vincent was saying that, you know, he's a young man as far, you know, in cycling terms, and he thinks that he could do a career you know, as long as Jens Voigt or this kind of guys, because he's fresh, you know, there's lots of freshness.
I mean, he's been a professional about the same length of time as Thibaut Pinot, hasn't he? Yeah. On the road, at least. He was a mountain biker before then. Lionel, I forgot to ask you where we are. You better describe where we are.
Well, we're at the foot of the Pyrenees, basically, in Argelès-Gazost, at the more or less the foot of Otakam, where the 18th stage of the race finished this afternoon with another stage win, his fourth for Vincenzo Nibali. Overall is now wrapped up.
Do you think he's going to win?
I'm going to, an exclusive for the podcast, I think Vincenzo Nibali is going to win the Tour de France now. Mm, how far clear is he? 7:10 clear of Thibaut Pinot.
You don't think Pinot can take back 7 minutes in the time trial?
It would take a miracle, you know. If he goes to Lourdes to the cave today, you know, maybe there's a chance he does something, but that's the only chance.
We're very close to Lourdes. I mean, we're very close to Lourdes indeed.
Just on that, actually, Sean Kelly took his yellow jersey. The one and only time he took the yellow jersey was in the Pyrenees, and his very good friend Herman Nice and Elise Nice, I think they were quite religious, they made a visit to the grotto in Lourdes the night he had the yellow jersey, and Sean Kelly lost about 15 minutes the next day, so obviously it didn't work for him.
Don't do it then, Pinot.
It did work for Gino Bartali, I think, in the 50s. I mean, the same thing happened, or was it in 49? I can't remember, but there was
a time... Were you covering that?
No, not at all, but I read, you know, I read books on cycling, do you? And I think Gino was very, very religious, as you know, and apparently he feared crashes, you know, because there were a lot of crashes, that, so he took his yellow jersey to the grotto and you know, and prayed not to crash, and he didn't crash. So you see, sometimes it works. So
great. Oh, here's Daniel. Daniel's just joining us here. Hello, Daniel.
Hey, chaps.
How are you?
Fine. Have we started?
We've started. Right. We've started. Yeah.
What are we talking about?
You're 3 minutes. You're 3:34 off the back. So you've got a bit of catching up to do.
Talking about cycling today.
Don't do a Rojas and hold on in the car now, or right behind the back of the car. He was disqualified today, wasn't he?
He was. Yeah.
Very rare that you see that.
He must have been holding on for a long time to get disqualified. I mean, we saw Rafa Majka got a little 10-second penalty and some points deducted from the points competition after he took that little toe on the motorbike on Wednesday's stage. But Rojas must have been hanging on from, I don't know, where we come from
today.
Well,
Thomas Vogler on the Tourmalet, I mean, we're all familiar with the sticky bottle, you know, the bottle that takes an awful long time to pass from the director's hand into the rider. The handover takes a while. He did the sticky bottle today without a bottle. It was just a sticky hand. But he took a little bit of a hand sling on the Tourmalet. It wouldn't have made an awful lot of difference. He was swinging a little bit by that point. But I mean, Daniel, we were talking with Francois about the French revival, obviously. In fact, the first time we had you on the podcast, it was the day that Tony Gallopin took the yellow jersey. So there's always a sort of theme of French success. But we were saying that this resurgence is probably unexpected. I mean, we've now got Frenchman second and third.
And fifth. And in fact, it could be the best overall result for the French since 91. First time, it's looking like the first time three Frenchmen will be in the top six since 91.
Yeah. Well, top six looks almost nailed on, doesn't it? But there's still an argument to be had about who's going to end up on the podium. Valverde was dropped again today, but Spanish time trial champion, of course. So it's very, very close between second and fourth, really, and it's all up for grabs, I think, in the time trial.
To add a little, you know, perspective on all that, I had a very interesting chat with French traitor Nicolas Portal this morning. You know, he works for Team Sky, as you know, and he was saying, you know, he was not downgrading the French performance, but he was saying, you know, well, of course the French are, you know, coming up and they're, you know, three in the top six or something, but, you know, bear in mind that four major riders are not here. I mean, okay, that's the race, but that's right. We don't have Froome, we don't have Contador. Rodriguez is not in his best showing on this tour. Nairo Quintana is not there. You could even maybe add Bradley Wiggins. Who knows? But which you know, without downgrading their performance, he said, you know, you must keep things in perspective. And he was saying that since he last rode Nicolas for a French team, which is a long time ago, because he rode for a Spanish team as a rider mostly. He said that maybe the culture of cycling in France was also changing, because in his mind, cycling had become a very highly professional sport in most teams, whether in France it remained, as he said, a cultural sport, like you relied on the tradition, old habits, sometimes nasty habits. And he said, well, maybe this is changing, but he sounded a little bit dubious. So
yeah, that sounds a bit like sour Pinot Noir to me. I mean, Francois, I mean, I've sort of said this on the podcast before, that in some ways I think the Festina scandal was the best thing that happened to French cycling, because there was a massive cleanup afterwards, but what it also did was made them, with their limited resources, look at things like, I remember Cofidis hiring a sophrologist, whatever, we never really found out what one was. FDJ hired Fred Grapp, a physiologist, in 2000, and they started looking into these sort of marginal gains that have been so trumpeted by Team Sky, mm-hmm. albeit with minimal financial resources compared to teams like Sky, and I think that's really bearing fruit now. And another thing I think we've mentioned in the past few days is that there was a power vacuum in French cycling. You know, there weren't big riders, and consequently guys like Bardet, even up to last year, 2 years ago, they've been thrown in, which is a luxury that the likes of Team Sky have not had, because the sort of leaders' positions have all been occupied, and they would never have thrown Thibaut Pinot into the Tour in 2012, which FDJ almost had to do.
That's right. The major question is there a Frenchman in these young French guys? Is there one that can win the Tour? It's very well to be on the podium, but to win the Tour the way Nibali is doing it, like, you know, he's really overwhelmingly better than everybody else. Pinot is excellent. He's got a wide progression margin, but can he win the Tour? I'm not sure. So, you know, lots of people say maybe the best Frenchman is not on the Tour, Warren Barguil. Mm. I also have doubts about it. Yeah. Sometimes you see a young rider coming up and you think from day one that this guy is going to win the Tour. I think Thibaut Pinot, Romain Bardet, they will be contenders in years to come. Can they win the Tour? I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the same before this Tour, and it seems to be going in like a 3-month cycle at the moment. Like, for 3 months, Barguil looks the most likely, then it's Bardet, then it's Pinot again. At the moment, it looks like Pinot, he looks the most physically robust to me, but then, you know, there are question marks about him mentally, and you have to give him a lot of credit for apparently overcoming a lot of the sort of problems that he had, not only descending, but just, you know, his general confidence, and also, you know, the criticism he had in this race after a week, because there were placement errors, and you know, it looked all set up for a repeat of last year where he would just implode mentally, and he's really stepped up, hasn't he?
Yeah. You know, this morning I talked to Yvon Madio, his team director, whom I've known from long years, and he said the difficulty with Thibaut Pinot is he needs to have fun on the bike. If he stops having fun on the bike, he won't be as good as he is now. But how can you maintain a level of fun in this game, in this sport, and be a Tour contender? Is it compatible? I don't know.
Well, it might not be so much fun for him coming here next year, with the pressure that will undoubtedly be on him. I remember last year, of course, he'd had this outstanding debut in 2012, and last year there was a lot of expectation, particularly the Mont Ventoux stage. That was the one that was being touted as the one that Pino was going to try and win, and I think he'd fallen ill even before then, and it proved not to be the case. The other Frenchman, who you mentioned earlier, Jean-Christophe Perrault, the elder statesman of them, I actually spoke this morning to Marc Sargent, his first professional road team director at what was then Omega Pharma Lotto in 2010. He signed him up to ride on the road, having he'd previously had a very successful career as a mountain biker. And one of the interesting things Marc Sargent said was that had the big hitters been here, Perrault would be about 6th, 7th, 8th, fighting for 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, and nobody would be talking about him. Nobody would even really be noticing him, partly because of the way that he rides as well. Anyway, I spoke to Marc Sargent, and here he is. I wanted to ask you about Jean-Christophe Perrault, your former rider. Mm-hmm. You obviously brought him into a road team. Did you identify his potential? Did you think he did have the potential to be a great road rider when you signed him?
Well, he was a good mountain biker. And when we heard about his ambition to be a professional road cyclist, we said, why not give it a try? That guy for sure has the quality. In the beginning, it was hard for him to be in the team. You know, mountain bikers, they're all by themselves. Also in the team, he was by himself. And that made it a little bit difficult. And then he quickly found out that it was all around the Tour van den Broek and that period was just before Gilbert, I think, and he thought, yes, I'm already into 30, I don't have too many years, I want to be in the Tour. And then he chose a French team which is near to his place, Agir d'Isère, and I spoke afterwards with Lavenue, and he also confirmed in the beginning it was hard because he was on his own. It took a while before he understood what it was to be riding in a team, but now obviously he's good.
In that first year then, he was still quite old, but he had a lot to learn about road racing. Was it difficult for him to grasp the sort of roles that you were asking him to do in races?
For sure, he knew what it was, riding even fast, and tactics he could understand, but it was like doing something for somebody that was like, why? Or so the team spirit, that was something he didn't understand. Obviously he understands it much better now.
And in terms of his physical potential, his engine, we're learning a lot now of just about what he's capable of. Did you always see that he had that physical talent?
Well, if you reach a certain level in a mountain bike, so the engine was there. It just okay, it's different, mountain biking or road races, but his ambition was to be a good rider in the Tour. That means 3 weeks of riding, and that took him a while. So, but I'm glad. I'm glad.
Are you surprised to see him, fighting for the podium here?
Yeah, because of his age. That was surprising for me. But if you see, all along the years, he's been a professional on the road. Now he's always there. Or it's Pyrenees or Dauphiné, or last year he had a bad crash here, or even two in a day, and he was out. It's not a big surprise he's there. Okay, we all know Contador is not here, Froome is not here. Otherwise, maybe it's a struggle for fifth place or sixth place, and that's a different game.
Were you sorry to lose him after a year?
Yes and no, because I was convinced about the potential he had, but the desire of being in a French team and doing the Tour de France was too big, and the uncertainty in our team was too high.
Do you keep in touch with him? Have you spoken to him much at this Tour?
No, but he's always friendly. He's waving, and no, we did not let him go on a... No, we stopped on a friendly base, let's say.
Do you think he will make the podium?
If I can choose one guy for the podium, I would say, for me, it can be on.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar, with Richard Moore, Lionel Burney, and Daniel Freib.
Well, we heard there from Marc Sargent of the Lotto Belisol team. You mentioned Nicolas Portal earlier, Francois. We bumped into Dave Brailsford this morning, Lionel and I, and we had a bit of a chat with him. But we should mention that Mikel Nieve, their Basque climber, local Basque climber, was on the attack For a lot of today, and it was eventually caught on the final climb, Hautacam, by Vincenzo Nibali, but he did get the combativity award, so Sky don't leave the tour empty-handed.
Ouch.
A first visit to the podium for Team Sky in this tour, maybe a last, I don't know. Sorry about that. Daniel, you have something to add on the disqualification today?
Well, I know a certain young Manxman, or not as young as he perhaps once was, but who will be rubbing his hands tonight, because Jose Joaquin Rojas, in 2011, you may remember, I don't think he directly accused Cavendish of holding onto cars. He was up against Cavendish in the green jersey competition, but certainly his team were accusing Cavendish of holding onto cars. And there were very lively discussions, I remember, between Cavendish's direct sportif, Brian Holm, and his Movistar counterparts. And yeah, he was thrown out today for holding onto a car.
Was it holding on or just sitting behind one?
Sitting behind, was it? Or?
Abri prolongé, okay, means prolonged shelter, you know. So I suppose, well, probably a little bit of both, because, you know, you need to stay in the shelter, as they say, for very long to be kicked out of the race, I guess. So I don't have the exact, you know, circumstances.
Maybe just motor pacing, maybe training for the Vuelta, no?
Ah, that's it.
Francois, just this is maybe something that Seb Piquet, who is the race radio announcer, talked about the other day, but I get the impression that Thierry Gouvenou's role is more prominent this year, and perhaps that he's having more of an influence on the commissaire's decision. Certainly he was put forward tonight to talk about the exclusion of Rojas.
Thierry Gouvenou is the new race director, taken over from Jean-François Pechot this year. It's his first tour, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. He's reasonably young compared to Pechot, who was, you know, forced to retire. There's another thing about the tour, you know. This is a sport that should be ruled by the UCI, right? And with commissaires and stewards and things. And you have the impression on the Tour de France that it's the tour directors who makes decisions. It's a little bit strange. So why Thierry Gouvenou shouldn't really come to talk to us about the exclusions or bans or punishments, because that's the UCI commissaire who should come to tell us about it. So that's one of the peculiarities of the tour, that, you know, it's so big and I guess the tour organization is so powerful that in a way you have the impression they make the decision instead of the UCI.
Maybe quite clever in that sense. Maybe it is a bit of a PR strategy.
It was a French TV interview, yeah, though, wasn't it? So maybe that kind of explains it. The UCI commissaires perhaps aren't going to talk to French TV, whereas Gouvenou would, you know, pop by. He was talking to Gerard Holtz, I think, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. I mean, as Seb Piquet said in our interview with him the other day, he has Thierry Gouvenou and Ingo Riis, the president of the commissars, in the car with him, and he said that they very much take decisions there in tandem. And in a car, but they take decisions together. They take decisions together that everything is agreed between the two of them. And obviously, there are commissars all over the race, in various vehicles and motorbikes and so on. So, but everything goes through Riis and Gouvenou in the car.
The Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Subscribe on iTunes, listen on Audioboo, and visit us at thecyclingpodcast.com.
So, shall we talk about Nibali and his performance on Hautacam? He went past Mikel Nieve quite impressively. We've not seen him accelerate quite like that in this tour, and it probably was, of his four stage wins, it was probably his most impressive. Do you think, Francois?
It was absolutely impressive. I mean, the way Horner went first, and you know, and all of a sudden you saw somebody chase behind Chris Horner, you know, and who would that be? You know, the yellow jersey. What is that? But apparently, you know, what the other team directors were saying is that, you know, Astana were you know, making the pace from the very beginning of the stage. It was quite obvious that anybody wanted to win that stage, and Vinokourov, his team manager, later said he wanted to show who is the boss. You know, so yeah, that was obviously the plan. Nibali wanted to not only win the tour, but winning because there's been criticism of Froome not being there, not Contador not being there, but by really being the boss of the tour in four stages, which I think with the yellow jersey, I mean the stat was going around the press room, so I guess it's right. It's apparently not been done since Eddie Merckx in 1974 that yellow jersey wins four stages outside time trials.
It's been done, but it doesn't count anymore.
Yeah,
but not race stages, correct?
Ah, road
this
stages.
This was the start. Yeah, this was the start.
Yeah, I think that outside, even the man we can't talk about didn't do it, you know, in his long reign. So
the Scottish play.
Yeah. Yeah, the Texan rider. Perhaps we should just refer to him as that.
Just on Nibali, there was an interesting little tidbit that he gave away in his press conference. He was asked whether he would have chased any rider or whether Horner in particular was sort of a red rag to him, because of course they had a duel in the Vuelta a España last year, and he admitted fairly uncharacteristically for Nibali, he's not someone who gets tied up in this kind of thing, that that was a bit of an incentive to go after Horner. I also remembered that Horner and Nibali had a bit of an altercation in Nibali's first year as a pro in 2005. He was riding for Fassa Bortolo, and the first significant performance he put in for Fassa was a breakaway in the Tour of Switzerland, and he was together with Horner pretty much all day. And I remember talking to him after that, and he said he didn't understand a word of what Horner was saying. Horner was remonstrating with him furiously all day. He said the only word that he understood began, I can't say it on the podcast, we are a family podcast, but it began with F. And Horner, I think, went on to win the stage.
Forza? Nah,
Forza. Yeah, yeah.
Let's sort of take a step away from this stage and play a little interview with not a local rider, but a Spaniard, and we're near to Spain, Juan Antonio Fletcher, who's been back on the tour this year. Oh, Daniel's got an exclusive bit of news about Fletcher as well. But we spoke to him a few days ago, and it's his first year in retirement. Former Team Skyrider, rode for Vacan Soleil last year, and he was here in a sort of media role, so he spoke a little bit about that and how odd it is to find himself on the other side of the fence. Just as we started the interview, though, he was interrupted by Dave Brailsford, who didn't realise he was giving an interview. So you'll hear their sort of little exchange at the start, which was quite interesting and amusing. But before we play the interview, Daniel, do you want to give us your Fletcher news?
I'm already prepared, but I'm trying to remember. Well, you will all remember Juan Antonio Fletcher's infamous now crash in 2011 Tour, when he was in a breakaway with Thomas Vogler, Johnny Hoogaland, and the rider who eventually won the stage, which was Luis Leon Sanchez or something. And both Hoogaland and Fletcher were hit by a car, and Hoogaland ended up tangled around a wire fence. Well, after that incident, an investigation was opened by the local parquet. Parquet, is that an English word? Yeah. Parquet, yeah. Or is that a French word? Okay. And the driver, I think about a year later, was eventually convicted and got a driving ban and a fairly substantial fine. But since then, Fletcher has also been pursuing a civil case, and he's looking for damages from the driver in question, or at least France Television, or the company that owns France Television. And he's in the process with, among others, Dave Brailsford at Team Sky, of trying to calculate the damages, the financial damages that he suffered as a result of that crash. And you know, I talked to him a few days ago about it, and he not only does he feel that it affected his next contract with Team Sky, so which you know it might have affected him to the tune of several hundred thousand euros, but he also feels that in subsequent seasons he was never the same rider, because he was traumatized by the crash, and whenever he was away in breakaways he was constantly nervous about cars, and he feels that it probably brought a premature end to his career as well. And that case is going to be heard in September, I understand.
It didn't put him off trying to get in breakaways, as I recall. He's always a very aggressive rider. But here's the interview, and as I said, Dave Brailsford spotted his ex-rider at the start and came and gave him a big bear hug, and you'll hear their exchange at the start of this interview. So Juan Antonio, you're back at the Tour de France. Do you miss it?
Well, I miss this guy. No.
How are you?
Yeah, you're all right.
What are you doing? Interview.
Feel free to interrupt our interview, okay. Dave. Feel free to interrupt our interview.
I asked
him if he missed Tour de France. Do you miss Juan Antonio?
Oh, come on! Hey, Thomas, he's a super character. Look at him.
He looks fit. He looks like he could still be riding,
surfing. You know, surfing. He's fitter than he was when I saw him in Catalonia. He was huge. Where have you been?
Maui and Bali. Yeah.
He'd been surfing and eating, that's for sure. But he looks all right again now. Look, yeah. Got himself back in shape.
I don't need to be in good shape either. Yeah, you so.
Hey, listen, I'll see you later.
He'd still be attacking no matter what. Juan Antonio, do you miss riding? Are you getting some pangs to return to racing or anything?
No, not at all. I think after such a long career, and the way I did my career, like full on every year, not even a room for any, you know, break in any season I've done. I think now it's like I still enjoy a lot of the sport and enjoy watching Tour de France. I really like being here and catch up with people and so on, but I don't miss the life that cyclists do. And I mean, I know what's the cost of being a, you know, a top rider on Tour de France, and that means you have to train hard, to commit to cycling and so many things that I've done, and now I don't feel up to it. I mean, especially because I'm enjoying life in another way. I really think my what people understand as a standard of life, that's what I'm starting now. So I don't change it. I mean, cycling had this its time, its years, and I'm happy with them, and now it's life. I mean, for me,
because we always, every race you rode, you were always on the attack. You were always very aggressive. I think your last race, you made a Tour of Beijing, even, which, you know, is a race that for a lot of riders is a bit of an anti-climax to the season. But even there, we saw you attacking. It seemed to be your mentality, and I wonder how easy it is to go from having that sort of attitude every race you start to just switching off from it completely. How do you find an outlet for that aggression now?
Well, as you say, I mean, I had some character in my racing, and yeah, I mean, I love sport. I mean, I mean, cycling is a sport that you're in nature, surrounding by nature all the time, and kind of individual sport. So of course, I'm not playing soccer, I'm not playing basketball. I'm still or either surfing or windsurfing, which is, you know, I'm still in a nature environment, and yeah, or when it's winter, sometimes I go cross country skiing or, you know, ski mountaineering and all these things. So I like personally to be out in nature and yeah, try. I'm not saying I'm aggressive or surfer when I surf or whatever, but let's say I don't miss competition. You know, one curious thing for me was that I also used to run once, twice a week. So I say there was this trail running race in Barcelona, and yeah, I said, okay, I'm going to be part of that. And then I saw this number of the race. I said, what I'm doing, you know, this is a competition. And I don't miss competition. I don't want to compete with anybody at all. I mean, so I didn't go.
You've got it out of your system.
Yeah. I said, what I'm doing, I mean, I understand people that they want to compete against others. But I'm not missing that. You know, I like sports. I love to run by myself. But I don't miss races,
okay.
You know, racing. So that's something that it's curious, because when you're a rider, you think that's the way you're going to be the rest of your life, or maybe you go out and try to do an Ironman. Or now I was thinking like that when I was a cyclist, but now it's like, no, I mean, I don't miss putting a number on my chest or on my at the back of my jerseys, or because I've done it many days a year, maybe 100 days a year for 14 years as a pro.
It's funny, because when you were a rider, when you were away from races, you were always very relaxed and talkative, and sometimes when you were in races, we could see how serious and how focused you were, and you were, you know, one of the riders who was maybe quite difficult to approach when you were in races. So does that give you a sort of understanding sometimes of when riders are under pressure and really just thinking about the stage ahead, that they maybe don't want to be approached and asked questions?
Exactly, as you say. I mean, I was not the best example as a rider has to be when for being interviewed and for being open for the media. When I was in the races, I needed to be so focused on that. I didn't want, you know, too many questions. So I was always trying to have a few questions, and especially I was appreciating a lot good questions. And I was appreciating when the questions were not about putting pressure on myself. So that's something that I see immediately from the riders. So I kind of protect the riders. I don't want to, if I ever make questions, have to make interviews to them. I mean, it's not up to me to put pressure on them. I really want them to enjoy about what I'm asking, and to let them express themselves, and yeah, to enjoy about the interview, they already have exactly. Yeah. I mean, because that was not the interviews I like. Probably some riders they don't feel uncomfortable with those kind of questions, but I did when I was a cyclist. So, I mean, I'm not taking that role. You know,
is it strange to interview some guys who you were racing with, teammates with last year? Is it odd?
It is weird, but I don't see myself a rider anymore. So that's a good thing. So it changed your mentality completely.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.
So we heard there from the recently retired Juan Antonio Flecha, who, as well as being a Spaniard and living in Barcelona, has a, I think he has a house here in the Pyrenees, up in the mountains somewhere. Francois is nodding. So
yeah, because I think he spent lots of time in Toulouse actually, and
he had a girlfriend there.
Yeah, he had a girlfriend there. He speaks very good French. I think he was talking to the pavé. You know, he had a thing for the cobbles, because when he was training in Toulouse, the street where he lived, there were cobbles. So I guess that there's something of that kind about Flecha and the area. So yeah,
I mean, I mentioned earlier that Lyle and I had a quick chat with Dave Brailsford in the Team Sky Hotel this morning. And we've been talking a little bit about this on this tour, and I think we've had some intelligence from the Sky camp that there's a lack of big characters on the team, real sort of talisman. And Flecha was one of those guys. I remember in 2010, their first tour, he was the one that was really... There was a stage actually in 2010 that went over the Tourmalet, and he was on the attack. He was in the break that day with Edvald Boasenhagen, I remember. But he was always sort of leading from the front, and he was always a very sort of big presence in races, and perhaps he's the sort of rider that they do miss.
Yeah, well, I was with the Team Sky kind of behind the scenes a bit during the 2011 Dauphiné, and I sat in on the team meeting a couple of times, and Flecha would pipe up and would give some really succinct, very short, but really to the point knowledge about the roads, or, you know, noticing stuff that other teams had been doing the previous day, or, you know, warning the younger riders who perhaps weren't as experienced what might happen. And he just seemed to be not just a influential character in that sense, but very upbeat all the time. Never saw him down, never saw him, He never seemed to sort of crumble under the weight of sort of stage racing. And even the day after, or a couple of days after that crash in 2011, where they were run off the road by the French television car, he was bubbly and upbeat about that as well. He didn't sort of, you know, mope around about it.
No, he had an incredible sort of attitude towards racing. I've told this story on the podcast before. That day, I think it was that day, the Tourmalet stage in 2010, there was a lot of, I think Rod Ellingworth was giving a team talk and saying, you know, come on guys, get in the break, be aggressive. And there were one or two dissenting voices in the team who didn't really see the point. And one of them, a British rider, went off to the toilet. When he came back, there was a post-it note on his chair from Flecha saying, "You will leave your balls on the mountain or you will not get back on this bus." Anyway, I've told that story before, but I'll probably tell it again.
Yeah, Flecha was always seemed to be in breaks. I have a problem with Flecha. That in the old days, we used to have pronostication contests at the village depot, and every day I was playing Flecha, he was not in the break, and every time I was not picking Flecha, he was in the break. So I have, you know, I'm very resentful.
Difficult relationship there.
Yeah, absolutely.
But just on the issue of big characters, I mean, Flecha was a big character, but he'd also been around a very long time. And, you know, I think when Sky signed him, he was probably in his 30s already. You know, Dave Brailsford is a subscriber to some of the sort of Moneyball theories. You know, Moneyball is the book written by Michael Lewis about the Oakland A's baseball team and the theories of Billy Bean. And one of the sort of key theories in that is that, older sportsmen tend to be slightly overvalued at times, and you know, one of the most dangerous things you can do is to tie older athletes down to fairly long-term contracts. So I'd be interested to see how Sky go about that, you know, picking up big personalities. It sounds like something that might be easy to do, but, you know, it can create dissension in the ranks, because, you know, by their very nature, big personalities are sometimes create conflict, but also they tend to be more expensive as well.
Yeah, just on that, the Team Sky and Dave Brailsford, they sit down and they plot their riders on a chart. Basically, one axis is age and the other is winning ability, and the other factor that they take into that is how much they're costing, and there's a kind of a bell curve. And so you can either be old and a winner, or, you know, really valuable to the team. You can't be a combination of the worst factors. You can't be old not able to win and expensive, and
that's
one of the most
was eventually.
Eventually,
wasn't
that probably was where he reached. You know, he wasn't getting the results, and he was costing them a few quid.
But character, I think, is it's very strange seen from a French point of view, because we tend to think, you know, the British in general are very competitive, and you know that grinta, like the Spanish says, is something important. You have to do your best showing it. The Sky are not the only team to have lost their leaders. I mean, they were many of them are on this tour, and we saw Tinkoff Saxo, for instance. You know, these guys are Omega Pharma Quickstep. When they lost their leaders, or the guy who was supposed to win stage as well, they bounced back quickly, and guys like Trentin or Mashka, you know, emerged thanks to the absence of their leaders. What the hell have the Sky Riders have been doing? There's a guy I've always been a great fan of. I think he's a great guy. He's got huge potential, and he was well placed in the overall standings as well. That's Geraint Thomas. Where is he? Why is he, you know, doing more? I mean, I've always been, this guy is an enigma to me. I really think he has a huge potential. He's a great guy, and he doesn't seem really to get this the edge within Team Sky. You never know whether he's a classics rider, he was a Paris leader, he did all right. He proved, you know, he's here in the mountains, can be a top 20 rider. So what, you know?
I think that's part of the problem. He can do everything, and certainly in this tour, in the first 10 days, he did do everything. And then I think his legs have kind of deserted him a bit in the most recent days in the Pyrenees. I think we've talked about this a fair bit on the podcast, sure, how good he is, but because of the role he was assigned, which was basically to do an awful lot of work for Chris Froome and then Richie Porte once Froome had crashed, by the time the time came for him to play his own card, he didn't have it.
I think we've also talked a lot in the past on the podcast about Sky's difficulty in classics, and how they're very good at riding to a plan and a plan A, you know, which they've had in stage races. And, you know, perhaps I'm just sort of throwing this out, I don't know the answer to this, but is this tour yet more evidence of, you know, a difficulty with kind of improvisation, a difficulty, like Francois says, of, you know, just summoning up some courage or determination, which isn't part of the brief necessarily when they when they embark on the race. I don't know.
Well, I wonder, just Kirienka yesterday, yeah. Nieve
yeah,
today.
They've certainly tried.
But Kirienka found himself out on his own. Nieve only had one other rider with him. Is there an element of, well, you know, they've not found themselves in the right moves? They've not been in company. I mean, Kirienka slogging away on his own, I mean, that was a mission to nowhere. And then again today, Nieve needed a bit more help, and he was doing all of the pulling on the climb really as well. So they've been hung out to dry a little
That's
bit.
Right. So something that Dave Brailsford told us, one thing that's concerned him at this tour is his health, and he said that there has been an illness that has affected Porte and also Nieve, and he's over that now. But that's not something that's something they've been able to manage in the past. And little things, like they've always been very big on, you know, hygiene, cleanliness, keeping hands clean, and he kind of let slip to us earlier in the tour that, you know, he had spotted signs of standards slipping slightly, and I think this is something that they're going to address very seriously. But what was most striking talking to Brailsford this morning was had this in 2010 as well, the enthusiasm that he has. And I've said this so many times before, you talk about marginal gains and everything, I think the thing that Dave Brailsford has in abundance is enthusiasm, and it cascades down. It did at British Cycling for many years, Team Sky as well. He's on it, he's already thinking ahead, and we had a very interesting discussion with him about a particularly audacious plan that he has a couple of years down the line, which can't say any more at the moment about. We'll maybe speak to him about that. But, you know, he is thinking ahead. He's not really thinking about this tour anymore. He's already planning ahead, and the enthusiasm I felt is certainly still there for it.
Well, while we've got Francois here, we really should talk perhaps a bit more about the French. I just want to know from you, Francois, Pinot and Bardet, of the two, who is going to be the best?
Well, yeah, you never know, because Perrault, as you know, Vincent Lavenu was saying this morning, it could still be around for 4 or 5 years. So
about when the tour next year
could be the older. No, I don't. Peru, I think he has huge potential in terms of just the engine, you know. But once again, you need the culture of road racing, and there are things you don't learn at the age he has. So well, you know, he probably belongs to the past. To me, obviously, the guy with the most potential is probably Pino. I think that just physically, the body is stronger. I think he can really, really improve in many, many fields. The fact that he's second in the Tour with being so you know, rough and raw and not entirely finished, points in that direction. The problem as well, I think Bardet is too much of an intellectual. He probably thinks a little bit too much, and he's very young, but he's already looking for you know, appraisal by you know, the quality papers and things. I'm not sure that's the mentally the right attitude to you need to be a little bit reckless and ruthless to be a Tour de France winner. Maybe Bardet is a little bit too soft.
I think when you mentioned Geraint Thomas, I think that's possibly the case with him, that you mentioned edge, the lack of an edge. Yeah. Perhaps he's too well adjusted in a lot of ways. What about the reaction in France to the French success at the Tour? Do you feel that France, you've covered the Tour since the 80s when, mm-hmm. you know, you had your Inos and your Fignons and so on, but do you feel that France has sort of reconnected with the Tour this year emotionally?
I think so. Not in terms of probably the older generation, but even Portal this morning was saying that his son, you know, was not a great fan of the Team Sky in many ways because he's French, was, you know, could identify with guys like Pino and Bardet. And I think for the younger generation, who in many ways, because of the Festina scandal, was not interested in cycling that much anymore. It was all about football and maybe even, you know, American basketball and things like that. All of a sudden, you know, they've got guys, you know, with the same, probably listening to the same music, the same attitude, and I think it's going to, if it lasts a little bit, it can have a huge impact on the future of the cycling in France and the way it's perceived. It's difficult for me to say, you know, what it's like when you're on the Tour, you're in the bubble, you're in the cars, people cheer at you, you're not outside, so I'll be able to answer that question after the Tour when I see, you know, the impact this has had on. But certainly in the press, it's all about Pino and Bardet.
I mean, I think Pino is in a fantastic position to sort of straddle a kind of generation gap as well, because there are elements of his persona that are very, and the way he approaches cycling, that are very old-fashioned. He kind of reminds me a bit of Marco Pantani in the way that, you know, when he goes out training, he refuses to take an inner tube, bizarrely, and he regularly has to ride home on flat tyre just because he doesn't want anything in his pocket.
A man after your own heart.
Yeah,
there,
yeah, yeah. And, you know, he relaxes. He's very fond of his fishing. That's how he relaxes. You know, he goes off to his pond. And, yeah, on the other hand, you know, he's young. He's impetuous. You know, he spends every evening playing. He either reenacts the stage or plays tomorrow's stage on Pro Cycling Manager every night.
He does.
And he's a huge football fan. You know, so I think there's a lot there to appeal to a younger generation, which France desperately needs, because another characteristic of this fantastic generation of young French riders is it hasn't come from a very broad base of participation. It's come from cycling families. They're all from cycling families.
That's right.
What about the media, Francois? Because the expectation is going to jump up tremendously from here. You must remember your second Tour would have been 1987, when Jean-François Bernard, tremendous talent, seemed to almost wilt under that level of expectation and pressure. And we've seen that to not just Jean-François Bernard, but other riders over the years, that it's a bit like the Belgians are always searching for the new Eddy Merckx, the French are always searching for the new Bernardino, and that pressure is almost impossible to avoid, isn't it?
I don't think, it's very strange, but once again, I think the impact of the Festina scandal was much more far-reaching than we believe, and even in terms of the media and the way to approach the riders and the champions these days. Nobody is ever going to tell you that Thibaut Pinot, Romain Bardet are the new Bernard Hinault or the new Jacques Anquetil. Nobody will, because we know in the past, the French writers, we know when you put too much pressure, it's true for, you know, football teams or whatever. If you too much pressure on these guys, usually they don't deliver, because I don't know why, it's something cultural about it, but the French are not very good under pressure. But in the same time, our press, compared to the British tabloids or to the Italian press or the Spanish press, is very soft. There's never like huge criticism of a guy because he failed. So I don't think Thibaut Pinot or Romain Bardet are really under huge media pressure. If they feel they are under pressure, they should, you know, cross the Alps and see what happens in Italy or places like that. So, I think that they're in an ideal position to mature and to bloom, you know, in a rather relaxed way. You know, there's no pressure. I don't feel any pressure from anybody for them to win the Tour this year or next year.
That leads me to another question, Francois, because arguably harder than finishing on the podium or even winning the Tour is to earn the approval, if you're a Frenchman, of Bernardino, the Badger.
You never get the approval.
No, who over the years has also been incredibly dismissive of whoever has been the sort of emerging French superstar for being overpaid or lazy or whatever. Does he approve of these?
He's been very, very discreet and very quiet. It's strange.
Especially
yes,
so.
Especially so, because usually, you know, you hear Bernardino is interviewed by everybody, and you know, and he says lots of things. Usually, it's on a British program, so I can say it, but he's known as being probably the worst forecaster in the world of cycling. Every day he says something is going to happen. You can be pretty sure that the opposite is going to happen. Unlike Jeff Bernard, who doesn't follow the race that much, reads the papers in the morning and comes up with a very good forecast on what's going to happen. But oddly enough, Bernardino has been very discreet, very quiet. I can't remember since the start of the Tour reading comments or listening to on the radio or TV talking about Pinot and Bardet. So it's really
probably odd. Hoping that Nibali doesn't fall off.
Absolutely.
You're listening to the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar. Tweet us at cycling_podcast.
So we'll wrap up this podcast in a while, because we've got to go to Lourdes, Lionel, and Daniel, I think, as well. We've got a night in.
I'm very much on the outskirts of Lourdes.
We're right in the centre of France's worst town.
Francois. Laughing knowingly at this.
I'm never staying in Lourdes. You know, the hotels are called Hotel Paradise or Hotel Heavenly.
It's a miracle for you to stay in Lourdes.
And it's very expensive, because you go there, you know, and you eat McDonald's, and I shouldn't, you know, make any more burgers. You know, at absolutely outrageous prices, just because, you know, it's a godly city. So no, I'm not staying in Lourdes at all. I'm in the mountain, only 5 km from
me
here.
Too. We'll stand on the mountain and throw tomatoes and heckle, won't we, Francois?
I've never been to Lourdes, but I've heard great things about it from Lionel all day. He was looking at to find the best restaurant in Lourdes. The best rated place on TripAdvisor is actually an ice cream parlor. But he says it all. Now, we'll wrap up in a moment. I was going to bring up a topic that is probably worthy of a much longer discussion, but with Nibali sort of riding away on his own today on a climb that's featured in the Tour quite a lot in the past, not that many times actually, but since 1994 it's been 4 or 5 times here. So there was the issue calculating power data from his time up the climb, and you know, this is something we discussed a lot last year. It hasn't really been on the agenda much this year. Daniel, I think you've done a big feature on this very subject in the latest issue of Pro Cycling Magazine. It just strikes me, I'll just say it quickly, that you know, we've been up here 94, 2000, 2008, I think are the three previous, and 96 of course, but each stage has been obviously of a different length, different climbs before it, a different stage in the race, different weather, possibly different road surfaces, different equipment being used by the riders. There's so many variables that go into the performance on the day that I just sort of scream in frustration at some of the stuff that's out there.
Do we know what Nibali's time was and what have the calculations
26th
been?
Fastest time.
Okay.
So it wasn't outstandingly quick. But that's not really the point for me. What if it had been really quick? What would that have told us, if anything?
I looked at someone published a list today of the 20 fastest times on Autocam, and it was just reasonable, the names there. I mean, you can imagine
but
who they're.
I mean, but the point is that since the Tour first came here in 1994, yeah, the Tour has only been here in a doping era, if you like. Yeah. So it's inevitable that the names on that list will be a lot of, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I would have, to be honest, having seen that list, I would have been slightly worried if, even regardless of what climbs came before today, if Nibali had gone faster than Bjarne Riis, I would have been slightly...
We didn't see Nibali get it in the big ring at all, which, you know, no, obviously slacking.
I did worry slightly because I think the moment when he went past Horner was on a real, was on a false flat, it was on a flat section, and it did look like he was sprinting. I was worried slightly that, you know, those pictures will be shown later and put forward as evidence of flagrant doping.
Francois, how do the French media cover this this scientific aspect of cycling and the times? Do they at all? Or
scientific, the big problem is no. There's lots of guys with blogs and stuff, you know, and there's lots of discussion about this scientific aspect. The problem of this is it really scientific? When we have a guy in France called Antoine Veillet, he's the former Festina coach, and every year he publishes columns in the quality papers, you know. And every time saying the guy who's leading the Tour de France is undoped because yes, you know, thresholds of watts, and it says over 410 watts the guy is doped, and then over 450 watts, blah blah blah. Every time you talk to a serious scientist, I mean, a guy who's at university teaching, who's worked in biomechanics for 20 or 30 years, all his life, what the answer you get is all these figures are absolutely unreliable and don't mean a thing. So it's I tend not to take this very seriously. I mean, it's great to make calculations and know the watts and the VO2 max and all this stuff is important for teams. But do they mean anything in terms if there were really a criterion, you know, for doping? I guess they would have been used long ago by WADA and other. So you know, it's nice because you can discuss those figures like in football, you discuss tactics. You know, they play in 4-4-2 or 4-3, whatever. But to me, it's a little bit as vain, you know, to discuss these topics because I'm not a doctor, I'm not a biomechanics specialist. I'm not certain all this is relevant, really.
I mean, I always go back to the point: how do we know what people are capable of? How do we know what the outer limits are? If you've not actually studied that particular individual, I just don't know. What did you learn doing your feature, Daniel? Anything you can tell us in a few nuggets?
It could be a very long discussion, this. No, I mean, I went into it very sceptical about some of the kind of armchair detectives, I won't call them keyboard warriors, but Dave Brailsford last year talks about pseudoscience. But I think you have to differentiate between them because some of them are very, very intelligent people. I mean, some of the debate about this kind of thing tends to be among amateur cyclists that are very active on particular forums, talk about this a lot. I mean, some of their knowledge is absolutely extraordinary. It's useful. It is useful, I think, for identifying macro trends. And if we saw one year, if we took the whole population of the Tour de France riders and we saw that there'd been a jump of 20%, which if you had this kind of tool available in 1992, 1993, 1994, there would have been a point where you would have seen a huge jump in performances. That would have been very, very useful, but more to sound an alarm bell and say something is going on here, not to identify one doper or two dopers and say this guy is doing things that are impossible. You know, over the past two or three years, there has been no easily identifiable macro trend where you could say a new product must have become available. Even the kind of outliers, and you know, there are physiological outliers. There are guys who are just extraordinarily talented. You know, Fred Grapp, the FDJ coach, says that in every generation there will be three guys whose VO2 max is over 90, and they will do extraordinary things on a bike.
Yeah, I remember Greg LeMond saying in Le Monde, you know, quality paper, that over 92 VO2 max, it's very suspicious. And in the same interview, he says, at my best, I was at 94. So was it suspicious or was it just exceptional? You know, that's...
I think the other thing about this is that the overall trend of cycling is that the heavy era of blood doping has ended. It doesn't mean that it's completely eradicated, but the whole game of cycling now is to try and produce those type of performances without doping. So the whole idea of cycling at the moment is finding other ways and trying to get performances with clean athletes that do sort of match up to the era of the heavy doping of the 90s. I think the unusual thing, the unfortunate thing would be if somebody in the future, next 5 years, rode Hautacam and was up there in the top 10 of the fastest ever times if that, you know, you can't have a society where we just say, well, that automatically means that that person is doping. And the only proof of, the only indicator of doping is whether somebody is doping, not just their performance.
I just one last thing. When I was writing this feature, I spoke to Tim Kerrison at Team Sky. He gave me a lot of information, and he, as most people know, used to work in swimming. And in swimming, 4 or 5 years ago, there was a new type of suit. I don't really know the proper jargon. Suits, yeah. Swimsuits.
Trunks,
yeah. Which radically improved times, and world records just absolutely tumbled across the board. Everyone that was using these suits was, you know, was beating their personal best by, you know, several percent. Anyway, the suits were subsequently banned, and based on the way training was evolving, the way nutrition was evolving, Tim Kerrison said that you would have expected it to take 15, 20 years for the new records established with these suits to be broken. He said, in actual fact, those records have, most of those records have now gone, simply because a bar was set, and this was a new target for athletes, for swimmers, and you know they found ways, you know, and perhaps some of them found illegal ways, but they found ways to get back, to get up to this newly elevated bar.
Yeah, in the same time in swimming, because I know the story pretty well, because the French swimmers all of a sudden started performing very well. There was also a suspicion at the time that the suits were an excuse to hide the real reasons why the performances were getting so exceptional. So.
Yeah. What was that? What, flippers or fins or a motor or?
It was the material in which they were made. You know, the suits, they were integral. They were covering the whole body, and then they were made in material that, when you know, it's very difficult to explain. But you know, the aerodynamics of the material in the water made them very. Better than skin, you know.
But I mean, this is a very contentious issue in France, Francois, because here, of course, you have to wear speedos, you have to wear the little tight budgie smugglers, we call them, because you're not allowed, for I believe hygiene reasons, to wear big flappy beach trunks in
swimming pools. That's right.
I would try to go for a swim in the outdoor pool in Chamonix and was turned away in my.
That's right. You're not entitled to
go and get undressed. Anyway, we should wrap up. We weren't going to discuss that parody, but we ended up discussing it a little bit. I think that Lionel, you know, you nailed it, saying that the only proof of doping is whether someone is doping. Anyway, we'll wrap up there. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Daniel, thank you.
Thank you.
And Francois, thank you again.
Merci beaucoup.
Podcast daily during the Tour de France. This is the Telegraph Cycling Podcast, supported by Jaguar.